I'm a talk man. So the title of this talk is All Our Opinions Are Wrong. And I hope I'm not walking into a hornet's nest or beating a dead horse or resurrecting dead issues, which is a wonderful line from the Sherengama Litany. I just love it. Resurrecting dead issues, which we do all the time as we tell our stories over and over again, right? I wanted to go back to some, just touch lightly as a reference point on some conversations we had last January. On the first Monday night, I gave a Dharma talk on love. And at the end, when I asked if there was any discussion, Kim said, I hope you don't mind my using you. Kim said, a Dharma talk like that, and then I think about the conversation at my house last night. And we'd had the potluck the night before, and at some point, a number of us got into a conversation about Trump, you know, who is about to be inaugurated, and all are upset about that. And we may not have said things in the most skillful of ways, self included. And I've really, this was kind of a real wake-up call for me, so thank you, Kim, because it directed me towards looking at how I'm walking my talk. And of course, our talk is always ahead of our walk because it's way easier to talk than to walk. But I feel that it's particularly important. I mean, part of what's so valuable about this practice for me personally is that we put it into practice. We don't just talk about it, we do it. And so it got me to really looking at how I'm using speech in unskillful ways and how I could do to shift, what I could do to shift that. Which led me to this topic. It you know, kind of reminded me of this teaching, which is a Buddhist teaching, that all our opinions are wrong. And so what I'm trying to do today is pull that aspect of our lives, our views, our ideas, our opinions, our ideals, kind of pull that out as the part of our daily life for us to look at least within this Dharma talk. When we get to the discussion, we can go where we want to. And, you know, the Buddha had this expression that I just love. He talked about the thicket of views. And, you know, it just gives you a sense of the entanglements you can get into with your views, right? And, ideas, opinions, views get dissed in Buddhist conversation, Buddhist teaching, you know, they're seen as problematic. Okay, so, and, you know, I was once part of a conversation or listening in on a conversation at the Abbey where some monks were talking about why we aren't so socially engaged. And the gist of the conversation was that it's important that we remain neutral so that we're a space where everybody feels welcome and to come and practice their spiritual life, their religious practice. And forgive me, if you have a problem with the word religion or religious, I balk at both that and spiritual, so I don't know what word to use. So just if we can hold that all lightly, I'd be grateful. But in any case, the idea was, you know, that we'd be in a neutral space for people to come and practice their religion, whatever their views and opinions are about whatever, you know. And somebody said that even something like feeding the hungry, like we could offer a meal once a week, say, you know, doesn't work because there are those who think that you shouldn't feed the hungry because the hungry are lazy and shiftless and they ought to get jobs just like the rest of us. And for people, you know, they should work to support themselves. And for those who hold that view, that's an important view to them, you know, and they think they're just as much right as those of us who think we should feed the hungry, you know. So, the question, it begs the question for me of, aren't there some things that are indisputable, you know, like feeding the hungry, or like freedom or human rights or justice, respect, inclusiveness, non-discrimination, a peaceful world, you know, no war, or, you know, like It's not a good idea to walk into a marketplace and detonate a bomb that kills a bunch of people, or walk into a school and shoot 40 kids. You know, I mean, you can hear my voice. There's this part of me that says, shouldn't, those things are wrong, you know? And isn't my view about that a legitimate point of view? And the people who disagree with me, they're crazy or whatever, you know, whatever, wherever we go with that, okay? And it's an interesting question to ask, that, you know, you, of course we're right, we shouldn't go into a school and shoot 40 kids, you know? But there's this Buddhist teaching that all of our opinions are false or wrong. And the question that leads me to is, can we live with that? And can we live with an aspect of our practice that pushes us into places that are uncomfortable for us? And I want to talk about that uncomfortableness for a little bit. And I want to talk about it. Last March, when I was at the Hermitage, I read Mu Soeng. Soeng's commentary on trust in mind. Trust is mind, in mind is a long 8th, 9th century poem that Reverend Master Hubert translated as that which is engraved upon the heart that trusts to the eternal, and that's in Buddhist writings for those of you who are familiar with that book. And Judy had recommended this book, and I finally got around to reading, and it's a really wonderful book. And there's a place in it where he is reflecting on some writings of Ken Wilber, who is kind of the guru of transpersonal psychology. And if you don't know who he is or what transpersonal psychology is, it doesn't really matter. But Ken Wilber draws this distinction between translation and transformation. And I want to read it the way he puts it, because he puts it really nicely. He says, with translation, and he's talking about religion, okay? So wherever we go to practice our religion, in whatever faith or our spirituality, however we do that. With translation, the self is simply given a new way to think about reality. The self is given a new way to think about it. The self is given a new belief, perhaps holistic instead of atomistic, perhaps forgiveness instead of blame, perhaps relational instead of analytic. So you can see how our values might fall on one side of that. The self then learns to translate its world and its being in terms of this new belief or new language or new paradigm. And this new enchanting translation, and I love that word, enchanting, you know, it kind of seduces us in, right? This new enchanting translation acts, at least temporarily, to alleviate or diminish the terror inherent in the heart of the separate self. Don't you just love that? I mean, it really, yeah, the terror inherent in the heart of the separate self, you know, which is, yeah. This function of religion does not usually or necessarily change the level of consciousness in a person. It doesn't deliver radical transformation, nor does it deliver a shattering liberation from the separate self altogether. And Mary used the word shattering the self at our discussion yesterday. I said, hey, don't get my Dharma talk. Anyway, nor does it deliver a shattering liberation from the separate self altogether. Rather, it consoles the self, fortifies the self, defends the self, promotes the self. Now, I think that's a really interesting perspective, and consoles the self. And yes, we do come to our spiritual practice because it brings consolation, comfort, support, help, right? And I don't think that's illegitimate. You know, I think those are perfectly fine aspects of what our spiritual practice does for us. So what he's talking about is, you know, that we use our spiritual practice to shore up the self rather than to dissolve the self. And do we want to keep shoring up the self? Do we want to continue to be enchanted which is really just a way of saying we're deluded, you know, we're being sucked in by delusion. And what about that terror, you know, the terror that the separate self experiences? What do we do about that? Okay. Now, I think that there is a connection between this wish to be consoled or inspired or comforted by our religion and the dearness of our opinions and our wish for them to be right and our insistence that they're right. Okay, so hold that thought. Because Wilbur goes on then to describe transformation, which does not fortify the separate self, but utterly shatters it. Not consolation, but devastation. Does this ring true when you sit down to meditate? Not comfort, but revolution. In short, not a conventional bolstering of consciousness, but a radical transformation, a radical transmutation and transformation at the deepest seat of consciousness itself. And, you know, he's pointing to the way in which our spiritual practice can either slowly or radically suddenly shatters the sense of a separate self, erodes the self, trains us away from our self-centeredness or our self-cherishing, and in a sense catapults us slowly or quickly into the non-separate self. Okay. And he goes on to say later in the book, this is Musoang now, says, radical transformation is indeed nothing more than ceasing to cherish opinions. So my question to us, to myself, is, am I willing to be devastated, shattered, exploded, you know? It makes letting go of the self look like, you know, maybe we should just be willing to allow that to happen, you know, in a nice, pleasant, easy way. Anyway, but there's a sense in which letting go of the self does mean that we're going to be shattered, as I said, either slowly or suddenly. So then Wilbur goes on, and this is the last line from him. Transformative spirituality does not seek to bolster or legitimate any present worldview at all. And this is me now. Whether it's a conventional or a countercultural worldview, whether it's politically correct or not, it doesn't support or bolster any present worldview at all. So if we're going to take our religious practice as far as we can go with it, we have to be willing to let go even of our fundamental worldview, in effect, our most precious opinions or views, the way we've set up and constructed the world. Okay? So, what's the problem with opinions? I'm shifting focus here. I'm moving away from, can we be uncomfortable and accept the uncomfortable aspect of our spiritual practice too? So what's wrong with opinions, okay? So there's a line in this poem, Trust in Mind, that Soang is commenting on. Do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Master Hubert translates it as, there's no need to hunt for truth. Simply stop exhaling personal opinions. Isn't that lovely? Stop exhaling. So the implication is that if we cease to cherish our opinions, the truth will be what's left and will be self-evident. Okay? And what we're living in the midst of. Back to daily life. Okay, this reality right here, right now. Now, another line from the poem says, at the moment of inner enlightenment, there is going beyond appearances and emptiness. Now, in a way, that appearances and emptiness is that same two truths we've been talking about, the absolute and the relative, or the universal and the phenomenal. I say that just for those who've kind of been involved in the discussions, and we've been kind of talking about that. But don't get caught up in that. Okay, so he's saying, The moment of inner enlightenment, there's a going beyond appearances and emptiness. And to me, the point here is that, and we talked about this actually yesterday at our discussion, that even emptiness with a capital E, shunyata, what we teach as, you know, all things and beings are empty of self-existence, that even that kind of emptiness is empty, that if we attach to emptiness with a capital E as a concept, it too, that concept too is empty of self-existence, right? Okay, and real enlightenment, and I've got a capital R there, stops nowhere, holds no opinions, and is never fixed. Okay, so opinions are wrong in the same way that everything else is wrong, in that they are empty. So we turn things like tables, you know, into things. We turn things into things, concepts, when what they really are is this undivided harmonious functioning that I've been talking about this week, which is a way I've got right now of describing non-duality. Because everything is involved in dependent origination or dependent on causes and conditions, because everything arises and passes away because of other things, other existences, because of that, there's no separate self. And because there's no separate self, there's no thing that isn't empty. Okay? So, just as the table isn't actually as we construe it, or isn't the same as our conception of it, or the way we construct it, neither is my opinion. Neither does my opinion have that kind of reality, the reality we think we give the table. Okay? So that's the fundamental, you know, from the point of view of Buddhist teaching, that's the fundamental reason why all our opinions are wrong. Now, Katagiri Roshi, who the group is reading his book called You Have to Say Something, and along with pretty much any Zen master, says over and over again that Zen is not about conceptualizing, that conceptualizing or concepts are the problem. And because of because we conceptualize, we don't recognize emptiness. In a way, concepts become the opposite of emptiness, right? That's a bit too harsh of a separation, but because we're conceptualizing, we're not living in that, what we talked about yesterday, that state of kind of permanent non-contriving, non-constructing of reality, okay? And so we're not seeing what's really there. We're not present right here in the moment seeing what's really there. You know, so we reify things, we solidify them, and then we think we know what they are, and we're not really with them as they are, okay? And Zen, on the other hand, sees life as this constant flow, not a bunch of stagnant things or concepts or thoughts or opinions, okay? It's a flow of activity. That's part of what I'm trying to say by undivided harmonious functioning, okay? It's a flow of activity, not a bunch of concepts. And views, opinions, ideas, and ideals are all concepts, okay? So aside from that, what's the problem with opinions? Okay, here's my short list. Well, what I just said, they keep us from seeing what's really there. Our views are limited and prevent us from seeing the whole or what's actually happening. And they distort reality, reality with a capital R, okay? They can and do cause the arising of the defiling passions, which can and do cause the arising of unskillful action or deluded action, okay? So a lot of harm can come as a result of cherishing and clinging to our opinions, okay? They form the basis for attachment, so I just said clinging, you know. boy, are we attached to them or what? I mean, we're so attached to them, we don't see that we have them a lot of the time. Okay, and attachment, of course, is the cause of suffering. They make it impossible for us to listen, to really listen. Okay, what is it like from somebody else's perspective? And, you know, if somebody comes to me with an opinion that, you know, I just can't even stomach, I shut down to them, yeah? And so a lot of, well, you know, a lot of this is about how do I not shut down, but actually listen to what it's like from their perspective. So then they create enemies and animosity. They create animosity and then enemies, something like that. They separate us from others, from our world. From others and our world. They separate us from everything. They give us an opportunity to live in that terror of the separate self. They create exclusivity, prejudice, discrimination, which of course is, I wrote here, it stands in direct defiance of non-duality, which is inclusive. Direct defiance of non-duality. They set up the opposites. And opinions are themselves opposites, okay? And they further involve us in setting up the opposites of right and wrong, good and bad, ethical, unethical, etc., okay? And consider all the distress that comes in our lives from needing to be right. Yeah? We're all familiar with that. And ultimately, they cause violence and wars. Okay, so it's not just a little thing. It's not just, you know, I kicked the dog this morning, but violence and wars, okay? So we create worlds with our opinions, and these interact with the worlds other people have created with their opinions, and then the game is on, right? We're off and running, and none of this is real, with a capital R. It's all illusion, really, okay? And we're so seduced by our opinions, which really are our core organizing principles. You know, in a way, our opinions are what enable us to create a world and feel like we've got some, you know, it makes sense to us and we have some control over it. All of which is pretty necessary for human beings, actually. You know, you can't live without some control. You kind of need to know where your food's coming from, right? Or anyway. They become this kind of core organizing principle of our lives, so we don't actually notice what we're doing. We don't notice that we have the opinions, and we don't notice what we're doing with them. Okay, so we can actually be doing really fine training and completely miss this, not see how our opinions and views are functioning in our lives. And it's not just that we have opinions about our opinions, one of which is that the opinions are very important. And that's how the world is, you know. We can't, and, you know, the world has to, we have to live in this way, okay? And we can't even see this. And that's the dangerous part. That's the dangerous part, that we can't see that we're doing it, okay? Now, I want to, in a little bit of reference to last January, I want to say that I think politics really epitomizes the difficulty that comes up with views and opinions. And the problem with politics, to my mind, is that it's extremely oppositional. You know, I mean, we have a two-party system, right? It might help if we had a three-party system, actually. And, you know, you think about the reactions most or all of us had to Trump, you know, and the sense of opposition, that, you know, this gut sense, you know, that some of us may have had that this isn't okay, you know. And we've got to, yeah, never mind, I won't go any further. So politics is almost synonymous with the opposites. And, you know, the line, the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost, okay. It's, and in a sense, politics is the opposite of spirituality or religion, because it's about opposition, duality, and self-interest. And that's part of what makes it, in some ways, so pernicious, and why some monks think monks shouldn't even be involved with politics. Now, I myself don't hold that view, but this, and I'm stating the extreme side of this right now. Okay, so politics is an area in our lives where I think it pays to be particularly careful. Okay, so all that said about politics and views and opinions, we're all going to have them, right? And there's nothing wrong with engaging with politics. There's nothing wrong, inherently wrong, with engaging with politics, with being a politician, or, you know, with watching the news, and then with forming an opinion about what we see and hear, what we know is going on, okay? The having of the opinions is not the problem, okay? So, because we're going to have them. But given that, and given how much trouble they can cause, how do we then hold them or respond to them or live with them, okay? So I think the first thing is awareness. And to me, this is kind of the bottom line of our practice, and I say it over and over again. We have to notice that we've got an opinion, okay? We have to see it. So the first thing that's really important is to cultivate this awareness and watch out for blind spots regarding our opinions. You know, how do we... Blind spots are, by definition, something we can't see, right? So how do we see our blind spots? but, you know, we do. I mean, you sit in meditation, actually, and in the middle of what is arising for you, you begin to see your blind spots. Or, you know, and then this is partly why stillness and alone time and quiet can be so helpful, because you start to see your own mind. Well, you know, all the monks at the Abbey get an opportunity to do a solitary retreat at a hermitage each year. And I love being alone. So I come back from the hermitage all happy, you know, and other monks come back from the hermitage and say, oh God, there I was with my own mind. And I myself am relieved to just be with my own mind and not everybody else's. There's only one mind happening instead of 25. And the reason I bring that up is because I love the monks, they're dear, but the reason I bring it up is because in that quiet, I can actually see what my mind is doing in a way that I can't when I'm surrounded by lots of other people. And I'll notice habitual patterns that I hadn't even seen in 65 years of life, you know. So anyway, that's a plug for some quiet. And quiet helps us to cultivate awareness, in my view. Then, so, and you can even, you know, when you become aware that some thought process is an opinion, you could even label it, this is an opinion, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can identify it consciously as an opinion, and that can help. And then remember that all opinions are wrong, okay? And actually, Soeng, Mu Soeng, who wrote this book I've been talking about, he asked this question, what would it be like if we could train ourselves to softly note when we have an opinion? This is the deluded mind at work. So not just there's an opinion, but this is the deluded mind at work. Now, yeah, we can think about whether that's helpful or not, but it's an interesting suggestion, okay? And can we even be willing to admit that it's the deluded mind at work? And of course, the deluded mind at work, in some sense, is happening all the time, you know, and we don't want to use this as a way to beat ourselves up. It would only be helpful if it's a way to actually help us be more conscious of what we're doing and let go of the harmful aspects of holding an opinion, okay? Okay, then let go of cherishing our opinions, because we're going to have them. But you know, it's like we're trying to undermine the cherishing of self. And part of that process is letting go of the cherishing of the opinions, okay? Or the clinging to them, which is the cause of suffering. And of course, we cling to opinions because we think something bad's going to happen if we don't, you know? Our world, the world, whatever, will fall apart, however big or small that world is. Or we'll die, or we'll suffer, or, you know, something bad will happen to us. So there's a reasonable basis for all of this, you know. But anyway, so letting go of cherishing our opinions, and then letting go of being right, of the need to be right, right? This is really freeing, to let go of the need to be right. And self-righteousness, you know. Self-righteousness is extremely painful. but it's so fun to engage in. I mean, it's kind of weird that way. Okay, so opinions keep us involved in right and wrong, and if we have ever had the experience of the suspension of the critical judgmental mind, even for a couple of seconds, we know how freeing that is. So letting go of involvement in right and wrong can be really helpful here, very freeing. And we have to have a sense of right and wrong on some level, right? So we're working at different levels here. Okay, then we could try listening, okay, and noticing how our opinions are causing us to shut down to someone and preventing us from listening. We could practice acceptance. Now, I know not everybody resonates with that word, but living within acceptance teaches us a way of being, which involves sitting in stillness, responding rather than reacting, and engaging rather than anger and opposition. So sitting in stillness, responding rather than reacting, and the stillness provides the wisdom and the space to do that responding, and then engaging rather than opposing or separating. Okay, so engaging includes the connection with other beings. And then finally, and this is kind of embedded in all of this, take the third position. Do we all know what I mean by that? No? Okay. So Reverend Master Ju used to talk about, when the opposites arise, the Buddha mind is lost. And the way out of that, setting up of the opposites, like right and wrong, is to take the third position, which to her mind was to sit still in meditation and be directly with whatever's happening. Okay? So that you know it thoroughly and intimately. In a sense, you become one with it. And that diminishes the opposition and allows that sense of non-duality or undivided harmonious functioning to occur. Okay? And thank you, Corrine, because it was good to say that. Now, I would like to think, to go back to last January, that the Women's March last January was a way of actually taking the third position. That's what folks were trying to do. You know, they were just being human. And I didn't go, right? Because I'm not allowed to go, because we have to be neutral. But it was a way of human beings being together and just caring for one another and expressing that care and expressing compassion. And I'm saying this out of what I've heard about it. And acting as one might out of an understanding of emptiness, you know, and just accepting whoever was there on their own terms. Now, admittedly, you draw a kind of biased crowd with views and opinions to something like that. But my hope is that there's a way in which, you know, so all of this may be just wishful thinking on my part, but my hope is that there actually, and this is what cheered me up so much about it, was it seemed like there is a way in which we can act together in a way which is being what our religion and our spirituality teaches us without having to create a sense of opposition as we're doing it. Does that make sense? So it gave me hope that it's possible for us to do that together in a kind of political setting, you know, so that there's, we don't have to all go be monks in monasteries and, you know, that we can actually find some way to address our concerns about who's been elected president or what's happening in the world or whatever those concerns are, whether it's Trump or Obama who's been elected president. And we have a way to do that that actually is, I want to say tending towards the good. You know, there's that word good, which we have to use, but which is actually helping the situation in positive ways by, in effect, taking that third position in action rather than on the meditation cushion. Okay? And then finally, living directly in the world, which is kind of what I've just talked about and what we've been talking about all week, right? And it brings me back to that 10th ox herding picture that we talked about.
I'm sorry. I've just been thinking about it the whole time you're talking.
The 10th ox herding picture. That's okay, Linda. That we talked about at the end of, in January, two Januaries ago, returning to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. So after all of it, we just come back to living our ordinary daily lives, taking care, you know, and being with reality as it actually is. Being with the mundanity, if you will, of our daily lives, the pettiness of it in a sense, you know, the washing the dishes and the feeding the dog and the, I don't know, I was going to say changing diapers, but well, maybe for grandparents we change diapers. Linda's got that one, okay. the going to the grocery store, you know, the small interactions with the people who live with us, you know, and all the, you know, some of that's minute, some of it's rote, and yet that's the, well, as I said last Monday, that's where the rubber meets the road, really, you know, and where we're really, you know, so where we're really doing the practice. So being in, and what I'm trying to get at here is this, I keep wanting to put my hands together and have them melt into each other. That being together with reality, so it's not me and my life, it's just, you know, me and my life hyphenated, you know. It's a dissolving of the separateness, you know. So Aang says, far from being a nihilistic engagement, ending the tyranny of mental constructs. Now, he's shifted here from views to concepts, mental constructs, all the things that we contrive. Ending the tyranny of mental constructs is the liberation project in Buddhist teaching. Now, I love this word liberation, and there is this promise in the Buddhist teaching that it's freeing. You see, ultimately, all of this does console us, doesn't it? It makes us feel better. But once we put down our concepts, opinions, views, ideas, ideals, we can live directly in the world, as I just said. You know, everyday mind is the way. So we need not grieve the loss of our opinions. We're going to have them. But we need to see through them and see them for what they actually are and rejoice in the freedom that comes from seeing through them. Okay? Thank you.